Ryan coasted to a full halt near the foot of a large hillock. The rest of the companions stopped nearby.
Guess that's it. We made it farther than I thought.
At least we left the acid rain behind us.
Any sign of the hunters?
Don't see how.
Ryan got out and stretched with obvious relief. He then reached into the backpack on the floor to unearth a soup can-size object. He placed his good eye to the end of the pre-dark navy telescope and looked around, carefully studying the distant horizon. The telescope was an amazing little thing that they had found in the ruins of the Virginia Beach Naval Station. The unbreakable plastic lens was kind of heavy, but the scope compacted smaller than binoculars and was perfect for the one-eyed man. Turning slowly, Ryan could see only barren desert. There were some reddish mountains to the north, along with several sand dunes, but nothing else.
Clear. Didn't think the muties could follow us this far, but it never hurts to make sure.
Caution is the virtue of the wise.
So where are we?
Looks like Australia, maybe.
Tell you in a sec.
JB reached under his shirt for his mini-sextant. Facing the partly cloudy sky, he found the sun, got the half-mirror into focus, then did some fast mental calculations. Tucking the little device away, he pulled a pre-dark map from a pocket.
Best as I can tell, we're in Colorado, near the Utah border, just above the Great Salt. If we had any juice left, we could drive to Tucsonville.
The companions had been there a while back, and helped the local baron deal with a nasty infestation of stickies. It was one of the few villes in the world where they would receive a friendly welcome.
Utah.
Briefly, Ryan touched the leather patch covering his missing eye, remembering the nightmare once more. Then he shook it off. Mildred had said that a dream was just your brain cleaning out the dreck of the day, and carried no special meaning.
Something wrong?
A knife slipped into Jack's waiting palm. Squinting hard, the teenager glanced over the sandy vista, but there was nothing dangerous in sight. Not even a screamwing moved through the lonely sky.
No. Nothing's wrong.
Clutching the silver lion's head on his sword stick, Doc twisted the handle and pulled out a few inches of the Spanish blade hidden inside. This was near where he'd last tangled with Delphi, and he wondered if the locale had some special significance to the blackguard. Instantly, the companions drew their weapons.
JB with me. Everybody else stay with the supplies.
They moved protectively around the speedsters as JB and Ryan sprinted up the sandy slope.
Revolvers and muskets. Could be Mercy's jacking a convoy.
Saying nothing, Ryan took out the telescope and crawled over the top of the dune until the other side was visible. Through the scope, he saw a horse-drawn buckboard being chased by a pack of Norms on motorcycles, with an odd-looking war wag bringing up the rear. The huge Mack truck was pulling a long 18-wheeler flatbed trailer with wooden walls added. The planks were studded with nails, and louvered shutters hung protectively over the big tires. Even the cab was coated with wooden nails, making it resemble a thorn bush, and a colossal eye was painted across the planks covering the grill, the inhuman orb staring directly forward in singular purpose. Off by itself, a second war wag was burning out of control.
Wood armor. Smart. It'd be easier to make than sheet metal, look way a lot less.
Certainly better than sandbags. One cut and the sand runs out, leaving you with an empty bag for protection.
True. Stuff won't stop a grin, but then what would? Nice touch, that big eye painting. Bet a live brass that throws off the aim of most cold hearts.
Ryan changed the focus on the telescope and looked along the rocky valley, finding corpses scattered around and a smashed two-wheeler burning. A couple of horses were galloping into the distance toward a dry riverbed. That was when he spotted the cage full of dead people in the buckboard.
Slavers.
He studied the attackers closely and frowned at the sight of their pointed teeth, many of them wearing necklaces of dried human fingers and ears.
And cannies.
Which are the cannies? No, wait. See the cage. Dark night. Cannies jacking slavers. Kind of makes you wish for the acid rain to come, doesn't it?
The team of horses pulling the buckboard was cut off, and the two merged, the fighting going hand to hand. Knives and hatchets were flashing in the bright sun.
Hell of a fight. This could be just what we need.
Yeah, I thought of that. Notice those other bikes hidden in the crater with tumbleweeds?
I'm not blind. Those must be the reserve troops in case the fight goes bad for the cannies. Too bad there's only four of them and six of us, or else we could... You know, I just got a crazy idea.
Way ahead of you, my friend.
Ryan brought up the Steyr SSG-70
Better move fast. This could be over soon.
I'm already gone.
JB crawled backwards until he was past the curve of the dune and out of sight. Setting the barrel of the long blaster on the grainy sand, Ryan fiddled with a focus on the telescopic sight. A few moments later, he spotted a furtive motion near a group of boulders and saw three of the companions running low across the valley floor toward the blast crater. A glance down the other side of the dune showed Mildred standing guard over the piles of supplies with a scatter gun.
Here we go.
Ryan placed a finger on the trigger of the long rifle and chose his first target. With their weapons held at the ready, the three companions crawled along the sandy ground, edging closer to the ancient blast crater. JB checked the rad counter on his lapel and relaxed when there was only background rad showing. They needed those bikes, but he had no wish to charge into a hot pit to get the red cough. Nothing was worth that kind of misery. When they reached the clump of tumbleweeds, the companions saw that the desert plants had been lashed together with rope to keep them from rolling away on the breeze. It was a wise precaution, but having somebody hidden as a guard would have been a smarter move. Easing to the weeds opposite the combat, JB gently parted them just enough to peek through. Three cannies sat on the big bikes, resting their arms on the handlebars, grisly human trophies dangling from strands of rawhide. Every bit of chrome was covered with dull tape, and the glass windshield had been replaced with a wooden board bolted to the frame. They all had throwing axes dangling from their belts, along with revolvers riding in low holsters.
How's it going?
The Canny's Colt 22 had little stopping power, but he had found an entire box of cartridges in a crashed military wag. It was the find of a lifetime, so he was nursing along the 50 live brass for as long as he could.
The slaves are coming this way. We could attack them from behind, and then we
No. Dragon told us to wait right here, so here we stay till he signals us to join the fight.
Yeah, but they might be all chilled by then.
So? That only means we eat sooner.
Fearfully, the canny glanced skyward at the tainted clouds, then relaxed. They were the wrong type of clouds for acid rain. Besides, it wasn't anywhere near spring. Staying low to the ground, the companions separated to move around the blast crater in different directions. Leaving Doc near a scraggly yucca tree, JB headed for a pile of boulders. Without warning, a canny walked around a boulder tugging at his pants. The two men stared at each other for a full second, then the canny clawed for his axe as JB stepped aside and Doc lunged into view, swinging his sword. The canny grabbed his slit neck and looked into Doc's face with dull comprehension.
Doc, quick!
Doc and JB grabbed the dead canny and threw him over the wall of weeds. The warm corpse fell between the parked two-wheelers, and the canny spun at the grisly arrival. That was when Christy stepped into view, holding her AK-47. A moment later, JB and Doc appeared from opposite sides of the crater, holding their own rapid fires. Riddled with slugs, one of the cannies staggered around, still horribly alive, then yanked a pre-dark grin from inside the bloody tatters of his shirt. Thankfully, Christy took notice. A black hole appeared in the middle of his forehead, and his lifeless finger curled around the pin. Kneeling, Christy recovered the grin, while Doc and JB dragged the other bodies off the bikes. Briefly, they checked the corpses for any more grins, but there were only axes and handguns. Since the companions had much better weapons, those were left behind. Carrying too many weapons would get you killed in the Deathlands, even faster than having none. However, Doc did appropriate a cardboard box half full of .22 caliber copper-jacketed rounds. Those would make excellent trade goods at Avil. Across the valley, the battle raged on. The smoke was getting thick around the buckboard, making it hard for both sides to see clearly. The bikers stayed in constant motion, firing their weapons and swinging axes. The slavers fought back with whips and handguns, the flames from the muzzles of their weapons stabbing through the billowing smoke like angry lightning. One canny stopped to pull out a Molotov and light the fuse. His arm raised to throw, but his hand was just a bloody stump. Ragged tatters of flesh dangled from his wrists as the Molotov fell to the ground. Covered with fire, the man insanely beat at the flames. Meanwhile, the fire reached the gas tank of his bike.
Shit! That bike's gonna blow! Clear the area!
Taking advantage of the explosion, the three companions climbed onto the big Harleys. Doc slashed his sword at the restraining rope. As the tumbleweeds rolled away, the companions raced out of the pit. Charging along the dusty ground, they curved around the fighting groups and went straight for the 18-wheeler Mac with a big painted eye. Akani smiled at the appearance of the bikes, then frowned as he realized they weren't his people. But he never had a chance to warn anyone. Ryan picked him off from above. Next to fall to Ryan Steyer was the driver of the war wag. Christy jumped off her stolen bike and charged for the wag. She yanked open the door. She climbed up onto the seat and pulled herself onto the roof of the cab. Staying clear of the protective nails jutting from the thick planks, she angled her Kalashnikov at the unknowing Kenny's in the rear. Christy saw JB sprint from his cycle, Uzi in hand, and leap into the wag cab. Stopping behind the war wag, Doc leveled his AK-47 and looked around frantically. In the pandemonium near the buckboard, a man turned in his direction. Doc swung up the rapid fire. But before he could shoot, the man doubled over, clutching his stomach. Ryan Steyer had connected first. Suddenly, a hatch swung open in the planks, and there was Christy holding her Kalashnikov and a gory knife. On the bloody floor, a muscular Kenny silently closed his eyes.
Change of plans. There's no room for the bikes.
Doc climbed aboard the back of the wag. Going to the front of the wag, Christy thumped a fist twice on the metal roof. Promptly, the war wag lurched forward. As the wag started to turn towards Ryan and the others on the hill, a group of Kennys looked up at the noise of the approaching vehicle. Realizing that they were being jacked while they were in the middle of a fight, the Kennys raced toward the companions. From above them, Ryan took out a bald woman whose arms were covered with tattoos. The motorcycle tumbled, and the truck plowed over it. More of the Kennys were running toward the war wag, their faces darkly grim. One Kenny pulled back his arm to throw an axe. Ryan shot him. Realizing finally that a sniper was in the dunes, the Kennys and Slavers both dived for cover. Inside the truck cab, JB stuck his Uzi out the broken window. He then ducked behind the door.
You can help!
A shot scored a bloody path across his left calf. JB switched legs and started working the gas pedal with his other foot. In the rear of the wag, Doc and Christy looked around frantically for a gun port, but apparently that particular invention was unknown to the Kennys. But there were boxes nailed to the floorboards to make steps so that you could get higher than the protective planks and fire at folks outside.
Have to do this the hard way.
Going to a firing step, Doc did the same.
On your mark, dear lady.
Suddenly, the wag jerked hard to the side. Scrambling to their feet, Doc and Christy raced to the rear wall and climbed on the boxes to quickly peek over the top. Several Kennys had reclaimed their bikes and were racing in hot pursuit.
Too bad for them. One, two, three!
Standing up together, they aimed their rapid fires at the Kennys. Pulling the pin on a Gren, Christy tossed it over the wall. She rose and aimed at the nearest biker. A tall Kenny lost his hat, and another fired back with a crossbow. Christy dropped the AK-47 and drew her SMW wheel gun. It didn't have the range of the AK, but it was much more accurate. The Kenny rider dropped his crossbow as blood gushed from a minor shoulder wound. The bike wobbled, almost toppling over, but the Kenny managed to right the two-wheeler and come on even faster. Deciding to follow the success of Christy, Doc slung the rapid fire over his shoulder and set the selector fin on the Lama to the 16-gauge shotgun. The pellets impacted the tire, the bike flipped over, and the lead Kenny went flying toward the wag as if launched by a catapult. The corpse dangled from the wooden armor, held in place by the rows of sharp nails. Holstering her revolver, Christy checked her pants pockets, then her shirt.
I need a lighter!
Searching his frock coat, Doc tossed over a butane lighter, one of several the companions had found in a New Mexican redoubt. Going to a box of Molotovs, Christy lit the oily rag fuses on several. She then grabbed the box and heaved the entire thing over the back wall of the flatbed. Finding himself alone, the last Kenny biker veered sharply away, zigzagging across the rough terrain. The Kenny swung behind a stand of cacti and was gone from sight. Angling out of the valley, JB drove the wag onto the desert and around a couple of sand dunes to finally find Mildred. The backpacks and extra supplies were piled around her boots. JB descended from the cab.
Anybody hurt?
I caught one in the leg, but it's just a scratch.
Are you sure?
Yeah, no biggie.
Mildred inspected the wound anyway. Thankfully, JB had been right. It was only a flesh wound. Yanking a clean cloth from her med kit, the physician tied it around the bloody pant leg as a temporary bandage. Later on, she would clean the scratch and give it a couple of stitches if necessary. But for now, that would do. The companions turned in the direction of the whistle and saw Ryan slide down the slope on the seat of his pants, the stire held tightly in a raised hand.
5 of them are still sucking air. Couldn't get a clear shot once they figured out where I was hiding.
Damn.
However, I did spot more tire tracks.
Delphi?
Could be.
Great. Then get your ass in a Cyclops and let's roll.
Ryan smiled. Cyclops was a pretty good name for a war wag. Just then, dust kicked up from the top of the dune.
Good shot. You got bikes?
Nothing that looked in working condition.
Horses?
Chilled or on fire and running for their lives.
On fire?
Yeah.
Damn. Poor horse.
Doc opened the wag hatch, and the companions quickly relayed their supplies and spare weapons inside the Cyclops, along with the precious toolbox and a couple of the nuke batteries. When he had the chance, JB planned to wire them to the wag headlights to make a nuke lamp. It was 100 times brighter than a flare, and would last until the halogen bulb died. The downside was they weighed more than a wheelbarrow, and exploded if dropped into water. But the nuke lamps were still much better than tallow candles.
Let's move it.
Jack and Mildred climbed through the hatch, and into the fortified 18-wheeler. JB re-entered the wag, again taking the driver's seat. Ryan took the gunner seat. The wag had started out as a flatbed, designed for hauling concrete abutments, steel girders, and other heavy cargo. It had an industrial transmission and reinforced frame, which made it nearly perfect for a war wag.
Head for the dry riverbed. That's the direction the tire tracks go.
Sure they're not from this wag?
No way. This heap has worn tires. The ones from the redoubt were brand new.
Fair enough.
The canny called Dragon and the rest of his crew crested the top of the sand dune.
Son of a bitch!
Holding a hand to his forehead to shade his eyes, Dragon stared hatefully at the moving dust cloud.
Gone!
Big Susie lowered her hand cannon and axe. The nicked blade was smeared with blood, with tufts of hair sticking out.
The Fraggin' Cyclops is gone! Black dust. We spent years putting the thing together, jacking tires, learning how to make shine, fixing the radiator. Shit, Dragon! You said there was going to be a peach. That those slavers would be easy pickings. Now we're stuck on foot in the middle of Muty Country.
Shut up, bitch!
Defiantly, Big Susie took a step forward, her hand raising the axe slightly. Then she met Dragon's cold gaze and went pale.
Hey, whoa. You know, I was just talking.
The man turned away from her and looked again at the vanishing dust cloud.
Bastards are heading for the dried riverbed!
Hey, what are those?
Parked at the bottom of the dune were half a dozen strange wags. The stripped-down speedsters had a metal cage around them for some reason, and seemed to be completely undamaged.
Why the fuck would they leave those behind?
Well, let's find out! And you watch for booby traps! These muty lovers are tricky!
Reaching the ground, the canny spread out so that any mines or pits wouldn't catch all of them. Circling around the speedsters, they found nothing that seemed dangerous, and finally Dragon walked up to one. Through the gridwork cage, he closely inspected the workings of the speedster, from the raised engine to the collection of nuke batteries. There were splotches of dried blood on the floor and dashboard, along with tufts of charred hair and some leafy vines. These had recently been in a fight with something large and hairy.
Well, nuke me! They came from the north!
Green hell? But that's full of those four-armed muties!
Which explains the cage, Hammer! They drove through the jungle in these things!
I'm guessing you're right, Pig.
The canny froze at the sight of the wiring going to the nuke batteries, then relaxed with the realization that if the bars were live, he'd be a pile of smoking ash by now. Sliding behind the wheel, the canny looked over the controls and soon found a newly installed button on the dashboard. It had to be the trigger for the batteries.
Oh, a sizzle cage. A smart. These things are only out of juice. Shit firing honey cakes. We're back in business.
Stepping from the speedster, the man grinned at his crew.
Pig, Susie, check over the stiffs and scav every weapon you can, especially any grins or firebombs.
What about the meat?
That's your job, Ryder. Take only arms and legs, and stack them in the rear. Lots of room back there with the batteries.
Sure, no problem.
What about me, Dragon?
Hammer, you get to dig up those extra cans of juice we buried in the blast crater. Haul them over and fill the tanks.
Oh, sure, I can do that.
As for me, I'll stay on top of the dune and watch for muties.
Nervously, the other Kennys glanced toward the sky. Already, vultures were circling high above the valley, attracted by the smell of blood. Soon, the Screamwings would arrive, and then the Stickies.
After we get these rolling, what should we do next? Head back to the caves to start smoking the meat, or...
Fuck that noise! We're going after the cold hearts that jacked our damn war wagon. Get it back!
The Kennys rushed to their assigned tasks. Dragon started up the dune once more. He knew a trick or two with nuke batteries that would make the thieves wish they had never been born. He could almost hear them pleading for death already. The desert got rougher as the Cyclops approached the bank of the riverbed.
Nukescaping.
Ryan checked the rad counter on his lapel, but the device registered only the usual background level.
We're okay, though.
Okay! Hold on to your ass back there!
As the war wag reached the irregular bank, the armorer twisted the steering wheel sharply, trying to angle in for an easier descent. The sun-baked mud crumbled under their weight, and the 18-wheeler tilted dangerously, almost tipping over.
Shit!
Jimmy tried to get the Cyclops under control. The war wag lurched forward to go over the bank.
Oh, that was fun.
We've gone through worse.
The dried mud was smooth and even, perfect for high-speed driving. In the rear section of the fortified Mac, the rest of the companions dragged themselves off the floor and started putting everything back into place. Backpacks and bedrolls were scattered around, one of them missing entirely, and the nuke batteries had slid straight to the rear of the wag, hitting the wood so hard they made impressions into the planks. A headlight was also smashed and a couple of small kegs had broken open, covering the floor with loose black powder and lead balls that rolled dangerously underfoot. Plus, several crates had flipped over, disgorging mounds of broken flints, musket parts, spare motorcycle parts, and a staggering collection of dried human remains, mostly fingers and sexual organs.
Kennys, they chilled now.
Jack took the box of body parts and emptied it over the side of the war wag. Then he thought about it and also tossed away the box.
Most of them anyway. Come on, let's clean this rolling abattoir before we catch the plague.
Finding some old clothing in a plastic box, the companions used the rags as brooms and swept the floor clean of powder and shot, then threw them over the side. They did a thorough search of every box, barrel, and crate, finding a fair assortment of empty brass, a dozen Molotovs, a hammer and spikes for repairing the wooden armor, and more trophies. In short order, the companions cleared away all of the grisly items, including a rope of what seemed to be horsehair.
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
Amen.
Opening the Molotovs, the companions checked to make sure the bottles were full of shine, not fuel, then used it to liberally clean their hands and to wash the badly bloodstained floor. Settling down, the companions dutifully checked over their weapons. They then started carving small gun ports into the thick planks.
Well, at least we have a lot of spare arrows. That's something, after losing all that black powder.
Those are not arrows, madam, but quarrels. Crossbow uses quarrels, not arrows.
What's the diff?
An arrow has a smooth shaft, but a quarrel is notched to fit the guide of a crossbow and stay in place.
Well, thank you, Ted Nugent.
Who, madam?
Never mind. Not important.
Slowly, the long hours passed, and twilight was beginning to claim the world when the end of the riverbed came into view. They came to a marshy field filled with what appeared to be wheat or some other kind of cultivated grain. Easing the Cyclops into the flooded cropland, JB was relieved to find the water only a couple of inches deep. However, the plants grew so close together, his view was reduced to less than a few feet ahead. If they were still following the riverbed, it was impossible to say.
Fire blast. We're driving blind. There could be Stickies or a bastard cliff only a couple yards away, and we'd never know about it until it was too late.
At this rate, we'll be in here until we run out of juice. How big was the size of the average pre-dark farm? A couple of miles?
More like 10 or 20. Sometimes a lot more.
Standing in the rear of the war wagon, the rest of the companions rested their arms on top of the spiked wood and used their vantage points to scan the vista of waving plants. None of them could see Predark ruins, abandoned grain silos, bridges, homes, barns, or any other sign of the prior owners, just endless acres of the gently waving plants. There were some mountains on the western horizon, but where the cropland ended and the rocks began, nobody could say for sure.
This crap reached to the foothills?
Mayhap it does, my young friend. We should be thankful this is not Australia. I have read where some of their larger farms extend for hundreds of miles without a break.
What is it anyway? Wheat?
Millet. Makes good bread once it's been cracked. Funny, I didn't think it could grow in wetlands like marsh.
Must be a muti strain, so I wouldn't try eating any until I've run some tests. There are grains that get an ersatz kind of mold that contains a natural form of LSD, a powerful hallucinogenic, 10 times worse than wolf weed.
Worse than that? Phew, nasty.
Any chance breathing it in might affect us?
No, impossible. You have to eat it. The mold was much too heavy to be airborne.
Hey, back there!
Brian craned his neck out the window.
Any sign of this field ending?
Not until we reach the mountains!
Let us know if anything comes into sight.
Will do!
Soon the plants were so thick around the Cyclops that the muddy earth below was impossible to see anymore.
Dark night, there's no way we're ever going to find any tire tracks in this. Maybe we ought to stop and... Damn!
The dashboard engine gauge swung fast into the red.
Think we blew a hose?
Only one way to find out.
They waited a few moments, but the gauge stayed in the red.
I'll check for the box.
Ryan climbed out of the cab. Staying on the corrugated metal step a good foot above the murky water, he pushed the seat forward. Most pre-dark trucks had spare storage there for small items, flares, shovels, tow ropes, and the like. But the man found only some pre-dark candy bar wrappers, a crumbling yellow sex magazine, a road flare reduced to waxy residue, and a few rusty tools eaten through with corrosion. Clearly, the cannies had not even been aware that the seat moved, or else they would have taken the magazine.
Nothing useful in there. I'll get the tools and gray tape.
JB stepped onto the wetland ground and walked around to the hood.
Get a bucket, too!
Steam was rushing out from around the hood. If it was just a hose, they'd be moving again in less than an hour. Ryan joined JB. The armorer tugged on his fingerless gloves and checked for traps. Sure enough, there was a booby trap, a spring-loaded blade set to chop off questing fingers. Using a lockpick, he easily disarmed it and cast the pieces aside.
Amateurs.
Ryan noticed some furtive movements among the muddy roots of the millet. It was most likely a rat, considering the combination of shallow water and abundant food, but that would be in their favor. Rats attacked people when they were starving, but with all of this millet around, these rats probably looked fatter than the ass of a baron's favorite gaudy slut. Bunching up a handkerchief for protection, JB raised the hood.
Definitely a split hose. Must have picked up some lead back in the valley.
JB's glasses were misty from the moist heat, but he could see the rent through the billowing cloud. Stepping away, he used the handkerchief to wipe his glasses.
Not much we can do, but wait until the engine's cooled enough to wrap some tape and twine around the split, then refill the radiator. I'll go turn on the heater.
Turn on the heater?
An old trick Trader taught me a long time ago. If you're short on time and the radiator's boiling over, then just turn on the damn heater. Sounds crazy, but turning on the heater helps cool down an engine. Trader said it could buy you extra minutes of driving, which sometimes was all the difference between sucking air or feeding the worms.
JB walked back to the cab as Ryan headed for the back of the wag. Christy was standing in the bed, holding the toolkit and a bucket.
Looking for these?
She smiled as she stepped down into the marsh. The dark water crested high on her blue cowboy boots, obscuring the embroidered spread-winged falcon design.
Don't forget these.
Mildred offered a fistful of relatively clean rags.
They'll do for filtering the marsh water.
Thanks.
Just then, a plump creature scurried between Ryan and Christy, then darted under the war wag.
Damn, that was a big rat.
Mother of God! Don't move. Everybody stay perfectly still.
Ryan and Christy froze, motionless. Warily, they glanced around at the thick rows of millet, their hands creeping toward their weapons. There was nothing in sight but the millet and the rats.
Easy now.
Mildred slowly moved her scattergun forward.
Get back in the wag and close the hatch. Easy. No sudden moves.
Cautiously, Ryan and Christy turned and stepped up into the Cyclops.
John, get the fuck out of the water!
Climbing onto a wooden box bolted to the planks as a firing step, Mildred rose above the wall and pointed the S&W M4000 at the hairy lumps waddling among the muddy stems of the millet.
John! John, where the hell are you?
Right here, Millie.
JB climbed into view on the roof of the cab.
I damn near lost my hat when I heard you shout like that.
Oh, thank goodness.
Mildred looked over the man intently. The cuffs of his pants were damp, but it only looked like dirty water.
Did any of them bite you or scratch? Even a small bite could be fatal.
The other companions scrambled onto the firing steps. They gazed at the sea of millet with newfound caution.
No, Millie, I'm fine.
Okay, what's the problem? Are there stickies here? Swampies?
Gator?
By the three Kennedys, I wish it were a gator. Good call, madam. I might never have recognized the rodents fast enough before they had swarmed through the hatch and into the war wag. I've only seen an illustration of them in the newspaper.
Keeping the rapid fire in hand, Doc also drew the Lamar.
Now we at least have a fighting chance.
What do you mean? Just rats?
Oh, no. Way worse than that. These aren't rats. They're selenodons. The bite of a selenodon is toxic. They were indigenous to Cuba and considered to be one of the most deadly animals on the planet. In my day, selenodons have been hunted to the brink of extinction.
So peaceful and tranquil before, now the field of millet seemed to be a death trap. They wouldn't have enough bullets to stop them all if the rodents attacked.
Is there an antidote to their bite? Cut the bite, suck out the poison, burn it with black powder?
No. A single bite from a pre-dark selenodon meant death. And these muties are 10 times larger.
Even the pharaohs of Egypt never faced such a plague as this.
It was their size that almost threw me. They're just so damn big. But once I saw that head...
How soon till we can move again, JP?
Half hour, maybe more. And I still have to patch the hose and refill the radiator.
Do we have to fill the tanks too, or do we have enough juice to leave?
No problem. We're good for at least a couple of miles. It's getting the water that concerns me. How much is in the canteens?
Walking over to the bedrolls, Mildred lifted the containers.
6 canteens, each about half full, say 3 quarts.
Barely enough. Nothing from the prior owners?
Sorry, no. They must have kept their canteens of water on their bikes.
Shit.
No, you mean piss.
Taking 2 canteens, Ryan poured the contents of one into the other.
Okay, people, fill her up. Every drop will help.
Shine, too. Little bit won't hurt much.
Any chance it'll ace the smell of boiling urine?
Nope. Make it worse.
Swell.
Mayhap Providence shines upon us, and this new breed of selenodon has no venom.
Could be, but I'd hate to be the one to find out. Look, we're probably safe inside the Cyclops as long as we don't annoy them. Stay quiet, let the engine cool, do the repairs, and drive out of here nice and slow. Everything will be fine once we're far enough away from here.
You may have just lost that option. Something's heading this way. A number of somethings.
Rushing to the other side of the war wag, Ryan pulled out his Navy telescope. Sweeping along the riverbed, he easily found a large dust cloud coming their way. Adjusting the focus, he saw the 6 caged speedsters they had left by the sand dune.
Fire blast, it's the Cannies. Bastards must have had a cache of juice somewhere for their bikes. They've come to get their war wag back.
As the huge black doors to the redoubt in southern Arizona opened wide, Edgar Franklin paused to frown at the dark tunnel. There should be a guardian here, and Everbrights along the ceiling. Clearly, something was wrong. For a brief second, the Titan agent panicked, thinking he had walked into a trap set by Delphi. Then he saw the destruction along the tunnel. Scorch marks pitted the curved walls, and mold on the bricks marked where the tunnel had once been 3 feet deep in water. There had been some kind of a major fight here, and his suspicions automatically went to Delphi. It was uncertain, however, who he had been trying to kill. Suddenly, a huge shape moved in the darkness, lumbering toward Franklin. Calmly, he studied the creature. It was a translucent blob, vaguely resembling a worm, but inside the living jelly was an armature of steel and twinkling lights, the metal flexing and bending. Franklin did nothing as the colossal thing approached. Towering over the human, it seemed ready to strike, then stopped dead. Reaching out a hand, Franklin paused, and the jelly parted to expose the armature. As he stroked the cool metal with a fingertip, the internal circuits read his fingerprints and a hatch cycled open, revealing a small control panel. A tiny rainbow-colored disc about the size of a quarter jutted from a slot. Taking a small box from his belt, Franklin inserted the mini-CD and watched. He watched the blast doors open again, this time revealing Ryan and the other companions. Hitting fast forward, the man skimmed through the numerous battles with the companions until the Guardian droid was destroyed in the massive explosion.
Well done.
The agent was impressed in spite of himself. There were very few people in the world who could tackle a Guardian and live. Yet these post-war vagabonds had done so with little more than raw bravery and a stolen APC. Franklin waved a hand at the Guardian, and the deadly jelly flowed to cover the armature once more.
Stay.
The Guardian bowed slightly and did not follow as the man casually strode along the tunnel. The Type 4 Guardian was not quite as smart as a Cerberus Cloud, but then it was harder to kill and lasted much longer. Two very valuable attributes. Plus, it was also harder to find. A Cerberus always reeked of ozone, and you could smell one approaching from 100 feet away. Try as they might, there was nothing over Project Whisper could do to correct that flaw, and so the other types of Guardians had been created to see which functioned the best as a possible replacement. So far, the question was far from being settled. After 100 feet or so, Franklin reached a huge crater in the floor, the rim broken and sagging. Now this was a recent addition. Going to the crumbling edge of the crater, Franklin looked down and saw only darkness. Using a thumbnail to flick the side of a ring, his entire hand began to glow, and he aimed the palm into the pit. The brilliant halogen beam stabbed deep into the murky recesses, showing the crumbled foundation and broken stalactites, of all things.
Bizarre.
Obviously, some sort of a river had been formed below the access tunnel. Probably runoff from the nearby mountains, the rushing flow undercutting the floor until it was so weak that the weight of the stolen APC had caused it to crash through.
Attend me.
The Guardian undulated into view and paused for more instructions.
Fix that, and reinforce the foundation so there will be no further collapses.
Obediently, the Guardian oozed away to gather loose bricks and other debris inside its translucent form. Proceeding to the end of the tunnel, the Titan agent studied the black rock wall for any signs of a breach and decided that the vagabonds had not left or returned this way. Going to a seemingly discolored section of the brick wall, he pressed a palm there and a panel opened in the rock face, exposing a small keypad. A blinding display of bright golden sunshine burst into the redoubt. As his eyes darkened to the hard exposure, Franklin walked out of the tunnel. A featureless desert extended to the horizon. Franklin made a curt gesture with his right hand, and a small compact needler dropped into his palm. Checking over the tiny weapon, he tucked it up the sleeve once more, then started walking due north. Roughly 100 miles away was the last known location of Delphi, a new city that the locals called Tucsonville. It was there he would begin the hunt for the rogue cyborg and Dr. Theophilus Tanner. The council had chosen him, and he would not fail.
Okay, we gotta move. Give me those bastard canteens.
Mildred stood on a firing step and reached out to press the straps into his grip. Their hands lingered together for a trifle longer than necessary. Then the private moment passed, and they were all business again.
We'll keep them off your back.
Damn well better.
JB scooted along the roof and onto the front windshield.
JB, here!
Jack tossed over a brown bottle. Turning just in time, JB made the catch, saw it with shine, nodded thanks, and tucked the container into one of the large pockets of his leather jacket. Then, grabbing the raised hood, he artfully swung around the dented metal, out of sight.
All right, we gotta keep them as far away from the wagon, JB, as possible.
Ryan placed aside the Kalashnikov and swung up the Steyr SSG-70 long rifle.
It'll be even worse if the Kennys toss a firebomb in here and set up one of these fucking barrels of juice.
Clusters of steel drums were lashed into place at each of the four corners, the old rusty fuel drums looming dangerously among the companions, like imprisoned foes just waiting to turn on their captors.
If one of those ignites, the Cannies wouldn't need to cook their dinner tonight, that's for damn sure.
We could dump the fuel.
Mildred stopped herself. That would only leave the war wag even more vulnerable, sitting motionless in a spreading pool of diesel fuel. Grimly, the physician made a hard decision and laid aside her precious medkit. She might need to move fast, and the weight would only slow her down. Slinging the AK-47 over a shoulder, she grabbed the S&W M4000 and moved to the front of the wag.
If any of the cannies want JB, they're gonna have to go through me first.
Bending to reach into a box, Jack pulled out several throwing axes and walked around the interior wall of the flatbed, stabbing them into the planks here and there. The axes were in case the cannies got inside the wag and the fight went hand to hand. The dire thought steeled Doc, and he went to the left wall of the flatbed to start emptying his frock coat pockets of grens and ammo clips.
Good thing the millet's high, or else we'd be visible for miles.
Think they'd be stupid enough to turn on the cages?
Ryan Steyer moved to track the distant movements in the plants.
Sure hope so. In this watery marsh, they'd fry their asses faster than swimming in a pond in Washington Hole.
Hey, that the Selenodons?
Down among the swampy roots, the plump creatures were running around, clearly excited about something. The teenager saw a faint trace of red in the dark water, and he recognized it as blood. The stain seemed to be coming from the front of the war wag. JB's wounded leg had to be bleeding again.
Stay here!
Okay, we don't need to be quiet anymore!
Aiming toward the crest of the wakes going through the millet, Ryan and the others sent converging streams of hardball ammo into the field. If they hit anything, there was no way of knowing. The companions stood on the firing steps to train their weapons on the greenery near the telltale muzzle smoke. But again, there was no cry from any of the cannons. Grabbing a gren, Doc yanked off the tape around the arming lever and whipped the explosive charge forward as hard as he could. The military sphere disappeared into the waving millet. Lightning flashed across the darkening sky as the engines of the speedsters changed direction toward the blast.
Chew them up!
The little Selenodon seemed to like fire and explosions just as much as Stickies did.
How you coming along there, lover?
The very plants that were protecting them from the cannies were also making it nearly impossible to kill the enemy.
Let you know in a sec.
A speedster burst out of the millet, the canny inside holding a homemade scatter gun. A barrage of broken glass and bent nails peppered the planks, splintering the wood near Doc. Turning sharply back into the millet, the canny wheeled away. Ryan caught a minor disturbance in the plants to his right. A speedster charged out of the millet and violently crashed into the 18-wheeler. The entire war wag shook from the impact, and Big Susie was thrown from her seat to smack into the protective cage. Mildred delivered a dose of double-aught buckshot. Susie was blown open, falling backward onto the nuke batteries. Her blood gushed under the terminals. Suddenly, the entire cage was covered with a dazzling display of electric sparks. Galvanized, the corpse jerked wildly, the muddy water sloshing over the rubber floor mats, bubbling. 100 Selenodons in the nearby roots went stiff.
Phew. They fucking smock. Shoot on to move, hide the track.
As Ryan worked to clear the port, a clay jug with a short fuse sailed into view.
Incoming!
Doc swung his Kalashnikov toward the bomb.
Got it!
Another jug flew toward the Cyclops, and Christy raised her AK-47. Then a speedster zoomed past the rear hatch.
This was their wag. They know every bastard inch.
A nuke battery in the speedster's rear split apart. But the driver still seemed alive, and the caged wag was still moving as it wheeled out of sight. Two more jugs were airborne. The homemade armor stopped most of the lead. One mini-ball punched through and grazed past Christy, striking her hair. Going pale, Christy's face contorted into a rictus of unimaginable agony as a fistful of her sensitive hair floated down to the dirty floorboards. Reeling blindly, she collapsed to her knees. Caught by surprise, Ryan looked away from the battle for a moment, then put his back to Christy and kept firing. Getting that much of her hair clipped had to have felt like having all of her fingers hacked off. Eventually, she would be okay, but she was out of the fight until further notice.
Come on, JB. Get this fat wooden bitch moving again.
The tattered stalks were starting to fall over to create an open space around the war wag, which was the last thing the companions wanted. Switching tactics, they started tossing the grens, trying to make the field impassable for the speedsters. But the companions had done their work too well, and the stubborn little speedsters merely jounced over the rough ground, plowing down more of the bedraggled millet. running low on grants, Brian got a box of Molotovs and pulled one out. Coming out of the millet, a speedster veered away from the flames and into the thickening darkness. The rest of the companions followed Ryan's example and reached for the Molotovs. The speedsters withdrew, but the companions knew they'd be back as soon as the flames died. And there were only a couple more Molotovs, nowhere near enough to erect another ring of fire. Right now, they had the advantage, but when the Molotovs were gone, the Kennys would highlight the 18-wheeler with their headlights, blinding the people inside, and that would be the end of the matter.
Almost there, Ryan.
I'm going out.
Ryan jumped into the mud.
Are you mad, sir?
But Ryan took off at a run, zigzagging past the fires and piles of fallen plants. It was time for the Kennys to get a taste of their own medicine. Ryan pulled the 6-hour and kept heading for the bobbing headlights. With all their zooming around, the speedsters had plowed crude roads through the millet, and Ryan stayed along the side of one, ready to dive for cover if one of the wags appeared. The shadows were becoming black, and he was starting to question the judgment of his plan when he came upon a speedster sitting in a small clearing, the canny inside the cage laboring to load a musket. Next, Ryan aimed at the fuel tank. He bent low to sprint through the sticky mud and found himself looking directly into the face of a big canny.
Whoa, fuck me!
On the truck, Jack kept a sharp watch for Ryan in the darkness. A speedster rolled into view, the big tires crushing Selenodons into the soapy mud. Dropping the AK-47, Jack whipped out his Colt Python handgun. As a fat canny lit the oily rag fuse on a Molotov, a wave of Selenodons came roiling out of the marsh, climbing all over the man, their claws and teeth slashing at his rawhide clothing.
Nothing faster!
The canny tried to yank one of the snarling muties off his chest with his free hand. Aiming for the canny, Jack changed his mind and went back to the Kalashnikov. This was not the time or place for mercy.
I'll kill you all!
Dragon, the canny leader, circled the war wag, steering with one hand. After firing his musket with his free hand, he pitched it and pulled out a pre-dark wheel gun. He knew that if he took out enough of the tires, the big wag wouldn't be able to move, trapping the companions among the Selenodons forever. As Dragon drove past the cab, JP swung his Uzi. The canny answered with a Molotov. The burning liquid engulfed the left front tire. Stepping into view from the plants and smoke, Ryan swung up the stire of the speedster. The speedster raced past Ryan, veering out of control. Ryan crouched in the filthy water, aiming his 6-hour at the speedster. Dragon thrust out an arm to raise a throwing axe, the dancing firelight flickering off the polished steel as if it was already coated with blood. Ryan ducked below the axe as the speedster raced past him. Then he put a round directly into a spinning tire. The rubber exploded off the rim just as Dragon turned to make another sharp turn, and the speedster flipped over, tumbling along the swampy ground to finally stop upside down. Tangled inside the cage, Dragon tried to reach the hatch as the first wave of Selenodons arrived. Yanking out the Kalashnikov that held up the hood, JB swung around the hood and onto the roof. Scrambling back into the cab, he tried to remain calm.
Move this piece of shit!
More rodents appeared to converge on the partially consumed bodies, white bones gleaming from the bloody tatters of the clothing. Muskets lay useless in the gory mud, and one speedster lay on its side. The truck jerked into the field of millet, the flames dying on the left front wheel in the watery mud. Suddenly, the tire blew.
Shit!
Struggling to control the massive war wag, JB alternated between the brakes and the gas. Speed was their only hope now, but the faster they went, the less control JB had.
Dark night. This fragging thing has 18 wheels and we just lost one of the two tires that matter.
In the back of the truck, a few Selenodons scrambled up the splintery wooden sides to attack the companions in the rear. Mildred blew the head off a Selenodon as he came over the top, and Doc blew two apart with one blast from the shotgun round in his Lamar. The explosions and blood only drew the attention of more of the plump animals, and the bloody mud darkened with their furry bodies.
Christy, wake up!
Several of the Solenodons scurried over the top of the planks. Mildred shot from the hip. The body's blown into hamburger from the stainless steel flechettes. A Solenodon scrambled over the wall near Jack and leapt for the teenager from behind. Jack turned in time to see the mutie explode into fur and guts. He spun to see a trembling Christie brace herself by grabbing onto a barrel of juice, the smoking S&W Model 640 tight in her fist. She was deathly pale, her animated filaments hanging limply as if ordinary hair. But her face was grimly determined, and her pistol swept the interior of the flatbed for new targets. Now the Solenodons were pouring over the barricade. The companions in the rear put their backs together to form a circle. The floorboards were littered with spent brass and dead Solenodons, but the little muties kept coming over the walls in ever-increasing numbers. Suddenly, the shredded tire came off the rim, and the wagon increased in speed. In the cab, JB shifted gears. The tall plants began batting the Solenodons off the outside of the vehicle. Soon, there were a lot less of the hairy muties making it over the planks, and then none at all. The Solenodons were still chasing after the war wag. The narrow path of crushed millet plants flattened behind the big vehicle, thickly carpeted with the plump muties. There didn't seem to be any end of the things.